Now, I was in Greenland a few weeks ago with Pini Wong, and at an informal dialogue of climate change ministers. And Pini, who is deeply committed to global action on this issue, let me tell you, nobody in Australia is more committed than Senator Wong, said to the developing countries, do you not get it? What the science tells us is that if all the developed countries in the world, including the United States, by 2050 go down not to 80%, which is monstrously ambitious, but to 100%, and you do nothing, we get 650 parts per million. Now, but ladies and gentlemen, if you're worried about the consequences of 450, which roughly equates to 2 degrees, you don't want to know about 650. So unfortunately, it's not a question of fairness or rich countries doing this. If the large developing countries permit us, do not start mitigation action, we're not going to do the work. Which is why this was such a serious mistake made by the negotiators. And it has to be repaired. We cannot replicate Kyoto. I mean, there's a sophisticated case, which I actually believe in, which says Kyoto by one measure has been a success because it's helped to galvanize opinion. But frankly, if you said that to a hard-nosed business person, they'd laugh at you because they say, well, what was the objective of Kyoto? And they'd say, oh, well, stabilize greenhouse gases sort of around 1990 levels. I think technically minus 5, I think, was the end. Well, how have you gone? Oh, well, not so well, actually. It's 40% above. So you want to do that again? Yeah. It would be like, you know, we're going to make this multi-billion-dollar in this failed company. Its return on assets is negative 20. We've gone to negative 40. Have we done well? Well, maybe we haven't achieved the primary objective, but we've got to know each other very well. So we can't do that, ladies and gentlemen. We can't replicate Kyoto, because Kyoto accounts for less than 30% of the net flow of emissions, and it's getting smaller. We have to have a global response. Now, there's a lot of flexibility around who, when, how, but if we don't get developing countries to take on mitigation, we're just not going to avoid the consequences, far more serious consequences of climate change than we're talking about before 50. Because one thing is clear, 450 doesn't mean fine. There are still negative consequences for the world at 450. But when you start talking 550, 650, you're talking something much more serious. Now, because of this gross strategic mistake, I'm reminded, we talked about Lord Keynes before. It's another phrase from another distinguished Lord in the English system, Lord Calder, Nicky Calder, well-known, one of the world's great economists in the 1970s of Hungarian extraction. And when Harold Wilson's cabinet was in complete crap, invited Lord Calder to give up his chair at Oxford and come in and try and become the principal economic advisor. And after he'd read the Treasury papers, and was asked by Harold, the Prime Minister, what he thought, he said, I've arrived too late, all the big mistakes have been made. Right, so what we're trying to do is repair this massive mistake. Unfortunately, it's got stratified into the negotiating structure through these two parallel tracks, the ad hoc working group on the Kyoto Protocol and the ad hoc working group on the long-term convention, the LCA track. And, I mean, the bifurcation of this negotiation is a hugely complicating factor because the science underlies it and the politics underlies it. I mean, I think public opinion has moved absolutely in the right direction in the United States. But tell you what, if you introduced a deal that said China's going to do nothing and we Americans are going to do X, it would still fail 95-0. In fact, no American negotiator would ever present that deal. So for political and science reasons, these two tracks have got to merge. It's phenomenally difficult for our excellent negotiators led by Adrian to do. This was all meant to come together, of course, according to the Bali roadmap. Remember, I wasn't making a joke when I talked about the Punta del Este roadmap being not worth the paper it was written on 4 years later. It's all meant to come to a full and ratifiable agreement in Copenhagen, according to Bali. Well, it's not. Because an international agreement finally has to be a text-based negotiation, you know, when I was a senior official, not a minister, I used to try and get ministers to understand that it's a wonderful speech you've seen that you've given, usually I've written it for them, of course. And have you seen the Tom Scott movie? In which I haven't talked to, I know Tom well, I need to confront him on this issue. Apparently there's a new movie out, and the star of it is the Minister of Climate Change. And he gets up, apparently, I haven't seen it myself, my colleagues in my office have told me, he gets up, he makes the speech, and his private secretary says, "Ross, wonderful speech, Minister," and he carries on. And the punchline is, "Oh, God, would you believe it? I stapled two copies of the speech together, and the idiot's reading it again." I need to confront Tom on that. Was it David Parker or me he wrote the So I used to tell ministers, "Look, you know, a speech is fine, Minister, but it's just evaporates. It doesn't mean anything. The only thing that means something in this world, this tough world, where nobody thinks they owe New Zealand a living, is the text. We have to negotiate the text. And that's what we need to do here." So what does the text look like? It is a complete mess. It's apparently, I'm too scared to look at it, so I'll rely on Adrian telling me about it. It's apparently 300 pages long with 3,000 square brackets. I mean, for somebody like me who's lived this life, that may cause a terminal heart attack. Now, some of you might welcome that, but I'm not quite ready to found it. So, what we have to do is, in 12 weeks' time, before we get to Copenhagen, is we have to have another result. I don't know what that is. The word at the moment is architecture. Okay? So, we've got a... That's CP2. And I suppose what the rotational negotiators means is someone's got to produce some working drawings we can use to develop in 2010, and who knows, maybe 2011. Now, this will be done in an atmosphere when NGOs will be saying this is hopeless.
It is.
The situation is getting worse and worse. And they will be right. And that's what's going to happen, and you better be ready for it. What might be the core of some working drawings, or architecture, or framework, or whatever word emerges from international diplomacy for what we're doing, which will be declared a success, of course? Here are some of my views. They reflect, in large part, but not completely, the views of my main advisors. I have a few other ideas as well. I think a global goal. This has been dismissed, I think, wrongly by concerned NGOs. When the small divertissement, the negotiations, as always, take place on a series of tracks. The global UNFCCC track, which I've focusing on here, buttressed by informal dialogues. The most important of them is the MEF, the Major Emitters Forum, which, Adrian, correct me, where are you, Adrian? Is, correct me if I'm wrong, essentially grew out of the AP6, didn't it?
Yeah, it was in addition to it, actually.
In addition to it, yeah. I think the previous Labour government made a disastrous mistake by not joining AP6. I don't think we would have carried ourselves into the MEF forum, but who knows what type of association might have been possible if they had not been seduced by nonsense rhetoric about this being a plot to avoid the UNFCCC process. A serious mistake. That process, which I understand has been transmogrified from MES, standing for Major Emitters Forum, to the Major Economies Forum, because they didn't like to be called major emitters. But they respond, they correspond to 80% of global emissions. If they can't do a deal, forget it, there won't be a deal. They agreed at the G20 meeting in Aquila, Italy, a few months ago, to a global goal of 2 degrees, which there's some technical stuff, not which I have to say I don't fully understand, about the distinctions between 450 and 2 degrees, but by and large, it's 450. And I don't understand anyway how you can actually target a degree change. They'll have to derive it from the 450 ultimately. So I think, except for people who are really into the science, assume it's one and the same thing. Why is this important politically? Why should you not write this off? Well, for the point Penny Wong was making in Greenland. Because accepting a global goal implies you developing countries, or the bigger ones of you, not just the tiny ones, to do mitigation. They should focus on adaptation. You have to do something because we can't get to that global deal that we just agreed on without you doing something. That's the ineluctable, inescapable logic of agreeing to a global deal. That is why some of the real hardliners in some of the big developed countries have so viciously criticized their negotiators for agreeing to this global deal. That's a sign that it means something. So I think that's the first. The second element is some type of targets, which gets you into the New Zealand issue. I think we've got to have some type of statement about what mitigation action the larger developing countries will do, otherwise there won't be a deal. There's a phrase in this negotiation, no money, no deal. There has to be some set of political understandings about financing for developing country mitigation and adaptation. And I also believe there has to be something on research, because we're not going to achieve this without some research breakthroughs. So, how is it going to come together? Well, the momentum in an international negotiation has to be imparted from outside the formal process. This is just a fantasy to think we can negotiate with 191 countries in the world. Never will happen. It's a recipe for certain failure, even in the long term. So, it has to start with the power grouping of the MEF, and that's far too large. Essentially, the deal has to be broken by the G2, China and the United States. They're responsible for 40% of the net flows. If they can't do a deal, there won't be a deal. Can they do a deal? I don't know. I mean, the chief Chinese negotiator announced to a grateful world that their emissions will peak in 2050. Well, if you believe that, they're not going to do a deal. So there we are, ladies and gentlemen, many uncertainties. I've just had a note saying, so I've got to go and answer a goddamn question on the sandpit down there on climate change. So I have to leave in 10 minutes, but I'm happy to take some questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim. If people can keep their questions very short to the point, that'd be great. Who'd like to start? Yes.
Thank you very much for your talk. You put a great deal upon developing countries needing to act. And for a minute, I thought I was misunderstanding, but I thought that it was that the developed rich countries are supposed to lead the way and provide an example, and then the developing countries would follow. What do you comment on that? And the other thing that I would like to comment on, if you're going to mean that developing countries should act, then the government should support coal from New Zealand not being exported to China.
Well, in the time available, let me just take the first question. You're right, and that's precisely the problem that I was trying to get across. Because it was agreed that developing countries didn't do anything, is the nature of the problem we face.
Oh, no, I didn't say didn't do anything. I said that the rich countries were supposed to lead
that's
the way.
Right. So they must lead the way, they must do more, faster. And that's not in doubt. But this has to be accompanied by some slow.
But the leadership has not happened.
You asked me the question, perhaps you like, unless you want to take over the lecture.
No, okay.
The reality is based on science. That if they don't do something, we ain't going to get there. So yes, developed countries must do more and faster. but the large developing countries have got to start taking on mitigation actions. It's a function of the science. And whether you think or not you can ban politics from this, you will fail if you think you can ban politics. The reality is you will never get the United States in particular to take action without developing countries. You can lecture them until you're blue in the face, but I'm telling you, madam, if that is what you believe, you've got it wrong. Other questions?
Simon Terry, just your comment about the actions in bringing in developing countries, obviously they're vital to the arithmetic.
Sorry, could you speak up some?
Developing countries are vital to the arithmetic. Can you tell me what's your learning from talking to other negotiators as to the willingness of them to finance not just their own abatement, but what developing countries are in a way asking for in the solution demands is that the West also finances developing country abatement?
Well, I think, knowing Simon, who's one of the best informed people in this country on this issue, are you, in fact, in a very subtle way, asking me about access to carbon markets and that issue?
I'm more pointing to that the British cabinet has just woken up to the degree of flows. The billions are not measured in single billions, they're measured in tens and hundreds of billions per annum. And whether negotiators are willing to meet that mark, because that seems to be, it's not the developing countries won't come in, it's who pays.
Simon, I'm deeply concerned about this. I don't think there's any way you can hide the concern. They need massive financial flows for adaptation and mitigation. And, you know, it's what comes to mind immediately is the 0.7% target in ODA. If you take the upper bound of some of those estimates, it's what's required. We would have to give from New Zealand four times as much as we did in England. And we are following an aggressive policy of expanding ODA. ODA goes up this year and carries on going to $600 million. $600 million is not small money. It's 1.5 times the amount of money I've been able to get out of the cabinet for the whole of conservation, as the Minister of Conservation, to manage 1/3 of the territory of New Zealand. We're talking massive amounts of money. So I think this is a hugely unresolved issue of immense political difficulty. But they ain't going to come to the party, and legitimately so, without financial assistance. And where the balance of this is going to be found through the negotiation process.
Minister, the New Zealand government has obviously its own responsibility target or range that it's proposed to negotiations. Has New Zealand got a position on what the overall responsibility target should be for industrialised countries?
Well, I understand where you're coming from, and the sum of the current bottom, if you add up the offers and take the upper bound in the case of countries like EU, Australia, New Zealand and others who said between X and Y, it's not 25%. The person I would most want to be here to give you this is one of the world's great brains, Jonathan Pershing, Dr. Jonathan Pershing. I don't know whether others, I know some of our team here know very well, but, and they would absolutely agree with me that, you know, if you want to pick somebody in the world who is the most fascinating person to listen to on this, you talk to Jonathan. He's this huge brain, totally committed to climate change. While he was in the outer years during the Republican, he was working for, was it the Pew Centre?
WRI.
And Jonathan says, this 25 to 40 is impossible. This is a guy who spends his whole life committed to this thing, so don't question his credentials because he's the number two US negotiator. So, to those people who say, you, US, the nasty US, you've got to do at least 25 to 40%, he says, well, I suppose if we abolish democracy and impose it, we would first of all wreck the world economy, is how I put it, if we did. Actually, what they're proposing is by 20, this is not very well drawn, because actually what they're proposing is that the US will stabilise in 2020 at 1990 levels. But he says, given that we can't possibly do this without technological breakthroughs, then the idea that in an 8-year period ahead of us to 2020 that you'd actually see very much reduction in our emissions is a nonsense. It's a technological nonsense. It can't be done. But if we are serious, the United States, if we the United States are serious, and we do make this massive policy shift and billions of dollars in investment in clean technologies, then the return from those investments will drive a steep downward curve. He absolutely rigidly contests the view that we need 25% reduction. Now, if you want to argue with him, which I wouldn't recommend, because this guy is just like massive brain, do so, but that's his view.
But Tim, just one supplementary would be, if we get a deal on red, and the United States need to take on a responsibility target above and beyond the domestic target of a significant nature, you get closer.
You could get closer. You could get closer. But it's not going to be, you know, people who think that just public opinion is going to drive this alone, irrespective of politics, are making a very serious mistake. I have deep respect for the base of this negotiation being public opinion. That's why I started with public opinion. That's why I made the point about Keynes saying, finally, the world of insiders, the world that I belong to and Adrian belong to, have to submit to public opinion. But there are limits. I think I've got to go.
Quick question, Minister. Hearing what you say about the trajectory, doesn't it force you ineluctably to take your position on the 2050 target? Other than 50% by 2050.
That's certainly an issue that New Zealand government may well have to face. I fully understand that. And I'm too scared to talk about it to my colleagues now.